Good evening, everyone. How did it get to be May and we're already at the end of the season? That blows my mind. It's gone whew, raced by. I try to explain this to my children when 5 minutes feels like an eternity. I'm like, just wait till you're 46. You don't even notice it. So tonight we open with a marvelous, effervescent work of Tchaikovsky's, the Polonaise from Eugene Onegin. And I could talk to you all about the underlying metaphor that the Polonaise represents. You know, Tatiana, after being rejected by Onegin, has grown and matured and married this wealthy aristocrat and is now at this glorious ball, which this music heralds the beginning of. And we could talk about all night about what it means and the distance she's traveled, but the bottom line is, it's just a great opening piece. It's a wonderful fanfare. The harmonic motion in the brasses over a steady repeating bass line brings all the glory of Tchaikovsky out in this marvelous, energetic melody in the first and second violins and upper woodwinds. It's a wonderful piece, and one could even argue it's substance-free music. It's just great to listen to. And we know much about Tchaikovsky and Beethoven, but not many of us know a whole lot about Borodin, and his music is not often performed, except for a handful of very familiar works that are played too often. But he actually wrote string quartets and quintets and symphonies and absolutely beautiful works that are too rarely performed. And I would venture a guess that you're actually quite a bit more familiar with his music than you might realize. Maybe we should just sing it. The first line, which is enough to jog your memory, but then I started listening to Vic Damone. Don't you just want to marry him? I mean, wow. And frankly, after you learn more about Borodin, I know I'm already married, so I don't know if you're here who you are, sorry, but he's tall, dark, and handsome, or was, just like you, and also like you, a scientist and a musician. And Borodin, I thought I knew things about Alexander Borodin, but really I just didn't get the full picture. How many influential composers can claim to be, let me get my list here because I'm going to leave one out, a renowned chemist who founded the Russian Chemical Society with Nikolai Zinin and collaborated with Dmitry Mendeleev, or Mendeleev, right? And he, what did he create? The periodic table of the elements, of course. He obviously is a composer, an educator, a great humanitarian, an advocate for women's rights in Russia in the education of women in the sciences, and a Tony Award winner. I mean, Lord knows he wasn't on stage when Kismet won the Tony, but the Kismet, which you just heard the most memorable tune from, was entirely made of Borodin's music, from his second string quartet, the second movement, which is the melody you just heard. And this is my beloved, that song is also his. And then the bulk of the rest of the score is much of his Prince Igor suite and Polovitsyn dances. So, you know, he's gotten around in his career. Twin obsessions with music and science. This strikes me as something that's unusual, but frankly, it's not. Just look at the population of our orchestra. A very, very substantial percentage of the musicians on stage are very accomplished scientists at the lab. When we think of people like Einstein, he was a violinist. Pythagoras, of triangle fame. he discovered musical intervals with varying lengths of vibrating string, and it was a musical methodology for many years before we got, you know, the tetrachord and fully understood the harmonic series. Next season, we're bringing a wonderful soprano, Heidi Moss. She's an accomplished and acclaimed biologist. So it's these disciplines are paired kind of naturally, and one feeds off the other. And that was certainly the case with Borodin. His twin obsessions with science and music started when he was a kid. He was born the illegitimate son of a prince and his mistress. The only reason his last name is Borodin is because the servant of the prince who was chosen as the surname for Alexander Borodin. The prince provided for his mother and child, and died when he was only 7 years old. And his mom gave him a very broad and liberal education and clearly let him literally experiment, because he was composing as a kid, age 9, 10, 11, no training, no conservatory training at all, self-taught on the flute and cello and piano. And during this time, this part of his childhood development, he built a chemistry lab in his mom's house. Imagine the household. I don't even want to think about it. And there are stories in the writings of Shostakovich and Rimsky-Korsakov in his adult years, when he was meeting with his colleagues in the Mighty Five, the mighty Russian handful of composers who really fathered Russian classical music. They would be immersed in their musical conversation or rehearsing or whatever, and he would suddenly just jump up and run away because some experiment had boiled over or exploded. And this greatly frustrated his musical colleagues. Balakirev is the only reason why anyone ever heard Borodin's first symphony, and it wasn't quite finished because, you know, Borodin was really busy and he just couldn't quite take the time he needed to finish the piece. It wasn't really a success. And later, when he did have time, he went back and reworked it. And it did become more successful. But his musical colleagues recognized this extraordinary, unique compositional voice who would just run off to the lab. that's in large part why his output is pretty small. And, you know, equally, his scientific, Nikolai Zinin would, you know, scold him for not spending enough time in the lab because he was off writing. So anyway, and in addition to his work in science and his clear musical talent and unique voice, his wife became very concerned with women's rights in Russia and the right to an education. And rather than just be sort of quasi-supportive, he took up the cause quite strongly himself and built a curriculum for women to study science in Russia, and taught many of the classes himself, founded an institute for them to further their studies, and that beginning is credited with a trend in Russian society that promoted women in the sciences early on. So, you know, this is why I think he's just the most awesome guy. And finally, one of the things I came upon that I just have to share with you. His scientific achievements. I left them out. This blows my mind. He and his colleagues were among the first to discover any real link between cholesterol and heart disease. And he developed the laboratory technique for binding fluorine atoms and carbon atoms, without which I think we probably wouldn't have freon or Teflon, which is stuff we take for granted today. So, I mean, how many composers can claim that in their other hobby, right? Anyway, not only was he a great humanitarian in his advocacy of women's studies and women's opportunities, but Rimsky-Korsakov described Borodin's house in this particular way. It was often used as a shelter or a night's lodging for various poor who picked that place to fall ill or lose their minds. Borodin had his hands full of them, doctoring them, taking them to hospitals. In the four rooms of his apartment, there often slept several strange persons of this sort, sofas and floors turned into beds. And later, in reading about his daily life, he would stop composing at the piano because too many relatively sick people were ill and trying to rest. So his depth as a person and his clear joy in his life, you hear it in his music. And tonight we will play for your work. Has anyone here ever heard the Third Symphony of Borodin? I haven't. This is my first live performance. it's wonderful. It's very representative of Borodin. He died literally dancing at a party with his friends. He had an aneurysm, boom, before he finished the Third Symphony. It begins with a very beautiful characteristic melody that the oboe plays, very representative of his melodic style. You'll recognize it immediately just from having heard that familiar song we all know. This is how the beginning of the first movement sounds. Answer in the woodwinds, that it's a little more punctuated. That second half of the theme forms the basis of the whole first movement. It's beautifully expressive, and I feel like we've developed more as an orchestra from playing it, because everyone has a melodic line of great importance to bring out. Where is it? Where is it? Can you hear it? It's been a wonderful thing to rehearse. The second movement, there are only two, is a scherzo, but rather than being a 3-4 time or 3-8 time like most scherzos are, this one's in 5-8. So it sort of feels like one half of your body is leaping just a little higher. 1-2-3-4-5, 1-2-3-4-5, with each step of your dance. This is the beginning of the second movement, the scherzo. Infectious rhythm that just compels movement throughout. And this scherzo has a middle section that's contrasting. It's a trio, and it's another gorgeous, soulful, Borodin Russian melody that you hear in the clarinet. This is the trio. So much of his melody made it into a musical. It speaks. Anyway, and that's all we have, two movements. It ends with a return of the scherzo and a little cute little codetta that ends sort of tongue-in-cheek and flits off into the atmosphere. So I think you'll really enjoy it. Now, I'm really delighted that my dear friend and esteemed colleague has agreed to come out and meet us in advance of her performance tonight. Elizabeth is here, and I can't wait to introduce you. I think she even has her own microphone. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Come on out. Oh, with violin. Welcome. You get to sit where I'm sitting. I had a little mishap with my left leg, but it's getting back to normal. I don't know. You can stand if you want. Or maybe, you know, I could too. You want to play games here? So, well, Elizabeth has been busy since she's been here. We've rehearsed twice, and then she gave us this glorious performance. How many of you were at the soiree on Friday? Quite a few people. That was so, so wonderful, and we're so grateful that you gave us that opportunity and that time. And for us, this is our, we keep talking about this, 20 years it's been since we last did a concerto together. And in a week, it's my 20th wedding anniversary, and Elizabeth played Pulcinella at our wedding. So I'm really having a great week. So welcome. Have you been enjoying your time?
Oh, I've been loving the chance to get to know Livermore. What a beautiful little city you have. It's so charming. I didn't grow up with a little town like this. It was just fields and woods. So it feels special in the community, meeting all of you and working with this wonderful orchestra and the beautiful Bankhead Theater and getting to see Laura after all these years.
Well, I was saying after our first rehearsal, Elizabeth has always been an extraordinary talent. And, you know, I think it takes nothing away from that to say, you know, and I think I have a fair amount of ability to do what I do, but 20 years ago, we weren't as comfortable doing it as we are now. It's just different to have that shared experience of musical education evolve over these years and to collaborate again after being through the trenches a few times.
It's very strange, even not seeing each other for 20 years. It just feels like a glove.
Right.
It's like, oh yeah.
Right.
This natural fit, because we did spend so many years together working every single week.
Right. Right. Yeah. And Elizabeth played in the conductor's ensemble of University of Southern California, which was the laboratory orchestra for conductors. And she might not be a true truth teller here, but you suffer with student conductors. You really, really do. We don't know yet what we're doing. We talk too much. We make huge mistakes. And, you know, part of the reason I can do what I do is because of what you did in playing in that ensemble.
And the debut orchestra,
yes,
where Laura was chosen to be the conductor for 3 years. It's a 3-year residency, which you're, it still is a very big deal. You were saying it was Michael Tilson Thomas's first orchestra, and Laura. So I was her concertmaster since we were going to USC together and happened to coincide. So for 3 years, we rehearsed together every Saturday afternoon.
That's true. Wow, I didn't remember it was Saturday afternoon, but it was. Good memory. But we never did Beethoven together. And I have to say, having done a lot of different violin concerti, this is different. I don't know how you feel about it, having played all the standard concerti. This one, I don't know. I feel like it's a perfect piece in its structure. It's perfectly balanced. The first movement is longer than a Haydn symphony, basically. And I wonder, I'm curious to know, when you're preparing Bruch, or you're preparing Brahms, or you're preparing Tchaikovsky, and you're preparing Beethoven, what are the differences? What's harder about it, or what's easier, or how do you approach it differently?
Well, Beethoven requires a lot of stamina, so it just takes longer to practice it, longer to play it, not to mention the cadenzas by Fritz Kreisler, which add considerably to the length and difficulty. And it happens to be the favorite piece of my father. So right after this, I'm going to record it in Bulgaria. And my father's 83, and I told him about it because I couldn't keep it a secret. Tears came to his eyes.
Oh my goodness. Oh my gosh. So we're the warm-up act for your recording. That's fantastic.
Beethoven is, I'm glad I didn't learn it when I was really young, because I think it's a very mature concerto, and I'm glad that I got to approach it as an adult. I learned it 10 years ago and performed it for the first time. It's a very deep piece, and there's always something more, always new heights. Mm-hmm. And it's just so pure and divine, but it does require a very fine conductor. It's a very terrifying piece for the orchestra. it's yeah. Many stops and starts and scary entrances.
There are many ways, I shouldn't say this out loud, there are many ways that a conductor can really foul this piece up. None of them will be on display tonight.
Yeah, so where I was going with this is Lara is perfect. She doesn't foul anything up. She's spot on, and it's such a pleasure. I can just relax, and the music flows divinely. So
that's
thank
a
you
high
so
compliment.
Much.
Thank you. Now, there's a little story, though, about the premiere of this work. I don't know if I'm going to get it right. Is it Clement who was the soloist?
Franz.
Franz Clement, who was a virtuoso in his day that everyone knew, was to premiere Beethoven's new violin concerto. The stories vary, but it's something on the order of it was barely finished, maybe a day or two ahead of the performance, and Clement did something unusual in the cadenza to entertain the audience and probably played extremely well, but with very little rehearsal time. It wasn't a hit. It didn't enter the standard repertoire for many, many years. When I think about this glorious piece not being played for that long when Beethoven was still alive, it re-entered the standard rep when Joseph Joachim, the great violinist who was so influential on so many composers, particularly Brahms, premiered the Beethoven Violin Concerto under the direction of Mendelssohn in London when Joachim was 13. And I don't know if we can trace the lineage precisely, but isn't Joseph Joachim one of the previous owners of Felix here?
Yes, it's kind of spooky that Joachim is known to have played a violin called the Red Stradivarius in the late 1800s. He loaned it to a Czech violinist, so there are articles about this Czech violinist touring with Joachim's Red Strad. And then the violin took on the name the Red Mendelssohn because it was owned by descendants of Felix Mendelssohn, a wealthy banking family. So both of them are sitting right here. They know the piece extremely well.
You just push the button, you know. Off it goes. Yeah, so I was asking Elizabeth in the car the other day, you know, is there any way we can say that Joseph Joachim, you know, was playing this violin when the concerto was premiered? Probably not, right? But just, it's a neat, what a wonderful lineage and what a great heritage. You know, when you think about the repertoire, the music that was being composed, you were talking about this the other day, the era in which this instrument came of age, and who was composing what at that time. It's just...
Oh yes, I mentioned that Bach had completed his six sonatas and partitas for unaccompanied violin in the year 1720, the very year this violin was made. The violin's still pretty much the same. The bow, though, evolved quite a bit since Bach's day. It was the curved bow, and now it's the Italian bow that's longer and stronger and bounces. But in Bach's day, they had the curved bow, which made it much easier to play chords, four-note chords. You could kind of roll it gently. But we traded that in for power and strength and all the dazzling strokes that the modern bow can do. But that was a 100-year evolution from that point.
Right. The changes in the world that have happened since this instrument was made. It's extraordinary what the legacy of your instrument represents, and you know what you do with it is astounding. It takes an extraordinary talent to bring the sound out of this extraordinary instrument, and to find the. I mean, I've so enjoyed hearing the range of quality of sound, of dynamic, of character that you find. In each opportunity that you have, and it's just instinctive. You must feel like you have a partner.
Well, there's always a range. Yes, it does feel like a partner. It feels like an extension of my body in the actual performance, and certainly a partner on stage and life. And you pointed out the other day that the 30 years and the 300.
Right.
The auction was in 1990. He was made in 1720.
Oh, right. Yes.
So I will have been partners with Felix for 30 years on his 300th birthday.
Wow. That's auspicious, is it not?
Like our 2020 thing going on.
Yeah, everything's, we're having all these 20th anniversaries right now. Exactly. Now, I want to, before we run out of time, you may or may not know that in addition to a very busy concert schedule, Elizabeth runs the Lucerne Music Festival every summer in upstate New York, teaches at the Colburn School and has taught at USC as well. And I'm curious to know how, I don't know what how complicated a question this is in the short time we have, but how your teaching informs your playing. If you find that things change about the way you feel about your work or about the way you approach your work or your actual technique from your teaching.
Well, I'm grateful to have gotten the chance to work with many students at the Colburn School. I studied with Robert Lipset at USC, which is why I moved from the East Coast to the West Coast to be a freshman there. And then I, immediately on graduation, I began teaching at USC and Colburn. These days, I'm full-time on the road, but I had 10, 11 years at both of those schools. And sometimes you just learn from your students. It's a give and take. And then at the Lucerne Music Center in the summer, as Laura said, that's near Saratoga Springs, New York, north of Albany. I'm around and I employ 28 teachers in the summer, 4 violin teachers, cello teachers, viola teachers, one of every instrumental category in the orchestra, including harp and percussion. And there we have about 150 students come through. And thankfully, the camp has been rejuvenated since when I attended in the late 80s as a 14-year-old. So that's why I'm so passionate. And we're hoping to get some students next year from this area to go and raise some money for their scholarships, maybe by coming back and doing a concert here featuring them.
Great. So sounds like a good idea.
Carrying on the legacy of these traditions that date back to these composers and these artists.
Exactly.
Right here in Livermore.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So do you, I maybe shouldn't ask this question, I don't want to jinx you, but do you have any, like, near-miss stories, or whoops, I left my violin on the train stories, or we almost left it on Trader Joe's.
You can tell our most recent story was in the grocery store.
Right, Trader Joe's. And I don't know, I guess you thought I was with the cart, and I thought you were with the cart. For a second, neither of us was with the cart, and you turned around to put, you know, avocados, and it wasn't our cart. And we both just went,
where's the cart? Felix was sitting in the cart, just upright, in the shopping cart, 20 feet away. And we both went,
oh! And I said, does this happen to you regularly? And all you said was, every day I don't lose this violin is a good day.
And then we equated it to, like, you know, forgetting your children to put it on a corner or something like that.
How many of us here have done that?
Fortunately, he doesn't have little legs and he can't run off.
Right. Be good.
Yeah.
Well, what time is it, everybody? 7:35. We have to go. But thank you for coming and talking to us. This is the awesome.